Candy is candy, right? Well, maybe not if you're trying to tax it. That's when the definition gets a bit sticky. Suddenly, a Snickers bar is candy, but a Twix isn't. This is an issue as states like Colorado and Washington move to tax sweets to help balance their budgets. Austin Jenkins of the Northwest News Network reports from Olympia, Washington.
Ask a group of kids, what is candy? And you'll get as many answers as there are flavors of Jelly Bellies. Take fifth graders Kaylin Singh, Nicholas Bourgeois, and Sebastian Groves from Maple Lawn Elementary near Tacoma, Washington.
Something that's sweet and people like to eat a lot with chocolate.
I think what defines candy is lots of sugar and it's not healthy for you.
Sugar!
Now here's the grown-up definition of candy.
The definition of candy is a preparation of sugar, honey, or other natural or artificial sweeteners combined with chocolate, fruits, nuts, or other ingredients or flavorings and formed into bars, drops, or pieces.
That's Patrick Gillespie with the Washington State Department of Revenue. His answer might sound a little bureaucratic. That's because it is. Washington State just passed a candy tax, and he gets to decide what is and isn't candy.
Okay, so Patrick, we're looking at the Department of Revenue vending machine, and let's test your knowledge. Reese's Cups, taxable, not taxable?
Taxable.
Mike and Ike's?
Taxable.
Kit Kat bars?
They're exempt.
Exempt, how come?
They have flour in them.
Flour, that's the not-so-secret ingredient that determines whether something is candy or not, at least if you're the tax man. If it has flour, it's not candy. No joke. Who came up with the flour test? A group of states working together to simplify, yes, I said simplify, and sync up their sales tax codes. It took them 2 years, and they insist the flour lobby had no influence in the matter. But the state's definition of candy leaves a sour taste in the mouth of Susan Smith. She's with the National Confectioners Association, also known as Candy USA.
We find that looking at flour as the definition of whether something is a food or not is really quite arbitrary.
So does she have a better definition?
Boy, that's a tough one. It might be the emotional definition that might determine what candy is rather than a specific ingredient or two.
Smith says her industry would be happy to work with policymakers on this, but cash-strapped states aren't waiting. Last year, Illinois adopted the flour definition when it stopped giving a sales tax break to candy. This year, Colorado and Washington State followed suit. Patrick Gillespie at Washington's Department of Revenue is building a database of every candy sold in Washington and whether it's taxable. He's at more than 6,000 and counting.
And you're not going crazy?
No, not yet.
You can just imagine what kids have to say about this. In Washington State, lawmakers have gone home for the year, but most days you can find a school group touring the state capitol. I found Mrs. Galvin's fifth graders quietly eating their lunch on the steps of the rotunda. Jeremy Healy views the candy tax as a personal affront.
I like candy, and if they tax it, I can't have it as much at all.
What's your favorite kind of candy?
I'd have to say the marshmallow Snickers. Those are good.
For the record, taxable. But there's hope for Jeremy. An effort is underway to ask Washington voters to repeal the candy tax this November. For NPR News, I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia, Washington.
And this is the time of year for commencement ceremonies that send college graduates out into the world looking for work. At a speech this month at Hampton University in Virginia, President Obama stated what most graduates already know.
This class is graduating at a time of great difficulty for America and for the world. You're entering a job market in an era of heightened international competition, with an economy that's still rebounding from the worst crisis since the Great Depression.
Now, the economy may be getting better, but it's still a rough time to try to launch a career. Today on Morning Edition's Business Report, we begin a series in which we'll meet college graduates from around the country. We begin with the very pragmatic accounting graduate. Reporter Emily McCord of member station WYSO has the story.
Meet Melanie Singer, a 22-year-old recent college graduate who majored in accounting. She grew up in a rural town in Ohio and then went to the University of Dayton, a private Catholic school. She got good grades, studied abroad, And according to her LinkedIn profile, her hobbies include hiking, sports, and fiscal responsibility.
Everything you read, accounting was in like the top five positions to get a job in.
She chose her major so that she'd be employable when she graduated. But while she was in school, the economy tanked.
After that, it kind of was like, don't just expect a job to come knock on the door.
Melanie's been working with a career counselor since her freshman year and did three internships while in school full time. She worked with a recruiter to help connect her with jobs and started sending out resumes at the beginning of her senior year.
I don't know how many websites or jobs I've sent my resume to. I used to keep a list of all the jobs I applied for and the ones I heard back from. But after, I think, a couple months, I was like, this is just, it's getting hard.
Melanie hoped she would have a job by now. And she fights back tears as she talks about rejection after rejection.
I don't know. You always want to put the blame on yourself. What did I do wrong? Did I say something in the interview that was wrong? Am I not qualified? Like, I don't know, you know, but what can I do better?
She tries to present herself professionally, dressing as someone you'd see around the office rather than someone on her summer off. Melanie seems well-suited to be an accountant. She's good at math and likes the idea that everything has an answer. But a job search isn't math. There isn't a formula that always results in a job. And that uncertainty is worrying Melanie, who has about $15,000 in student loan debt and is back living with her parents and her four siblings.
Coming from a small town, when you go to a prestigious school, you graduate with a great degree, and then you come back and you don't have anything. It doesn't look real good.
But things are looking up. Melanie recently interviewed at two jobs and is waiting to hear back. One is for a local freight company, the other at a business research group.
I guess crossing my fingers that one of these hopefully comes through. I really hope that within a month, I'll have something.
The waiting is the most, to me, the most difficult part.
Sylvie Stewart is Melanie's career counselor at the University of Dayton.
Because that's where you're using a lot of your energy, hoping and praying and begging.
Stewart says when you're waiting for a job, your perception of time changes. What can be a couple of days to an employer seems like weeks or a lifetime to a job seeker. And Stewart says lines like, don't take it personally.
A job can be more personal. It's your livelihood.
Stewart encourages students like Melanie to stay motivated and think long term. This is just the beginning. So it's a week after her interviews for that freight company and business research group. I called Melanie to see if her new beginning is taking shape.
Hi.
Did you find out yet? Any word on the job?
I heard back actually from one, told me that they had already hired a person for the position. And then I got an email on the other one saying that they had hired someone else.
Now Melanie's worried that she got so excited about those jobs that she fell behind on applying. But Melanie's trying not to be discouraged. In fact, she's contacting both of those employers to get feedback on what she could do better in the future. For NPR News, I'm Emily McCord in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Tomorrow we continue this series that we're calling Setting Out. We'll meet Heather Lefebvre, who's an English major from Brandeis University.
I'm trying to get a job in publishing. Frankly, I'll take what I can get right now. I've also signed up for some temp agencies because right now I need money.
New Orleans chefs pride themselves on, well, on everything, but especially their seafood dishes. Now Louisiana restaurant owners are worried that images of oil spilling into the Gulf will drive customers away. So some restaurants are suing oil giant BP proactively in case they lose a lot of business. In the meantime, they're spreading the word that their seafood is safe and still on the menu. NPR's Jamie Terabay reports from New Orleans.
At Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House on the same named street, 45 sacks of oysters get delivered and shucked and served. Leo Price taps his knife onto the shell, listens for a particular sound.
And when I tap on it, hollow sound means no water. And solid sound, it means the oysters good.
Those good oysters, piled on a half shell and stacked on the shiny oyster bar, are the first things customers see when they walk into the place. Lou Sandrell and Jane Lyons are visiting from Sarasota, Florida. They've had 4 days of gluttony in the city.
Oysters, etouffee.
It might have been redfish, but maybe not. Shrimp, oysters, a couple of ways. It's just wonderful.
But restaurants are bracing for a backlash. One owner heard about a restaurant in Illinois that's telling customers it doesn't serve Louisiana seafood anymore. And that, says Yule Smith from the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board, is the heart of the issue they're dealing with.
The biggest challenge we're facing right now is a perception challenge at this point in time.
He stresses supply may suffer eventually, but anything that might be unsafe is kept off Louisiana tables.
Continue to ask for Louisiana seafood. No restaurant's going to put bad food on the plate.
Safety inspectors agree. Bill Mayen from the Florida Sea Grant Program says authorities have added more inspections and precautions to be able to assure the eating public the food is safe.
The seafood at this point is completely safe, and it's been inspected, and it wouldn't be out in the restaurant chains or anywhere for sale if it wasn't safe.
But Yul Smith from Louisiana Seafood Board says he still has selling to do. Some money from BP to the state, around $40 million right now, will go towards a tourism campaign to help Louisiana's $2.4 billion seafood industry stay afloat. The state, he says, is the number one producer of shrimp, oysters and crawfish and ships supplies to 30% of the country. But the biggest problem is that the oil continues to flow.
If they don't cap this thing soon, the longer this drags on, the harder that perception is going to be to overcome that we have safe seafood.
Dickie Brennan, one of New Orleans' best-known restaurateurs, shares that concern.
As the day goes by, I must ask 100 people all day long, have we plugged the hole yet? And it's just a huge disappointment.
Other restaurants are enlisting lawyers to sue BP. George Cotello from the famous Frankie and Johnny seafood restaurant calls its suit a protective measure.
Because no one knows what's going to happen. We're just putting our ducks in a row, and if it gets worse and if we suffer considerable losses, then we have to go to BP to try to get them to make everybody whole.
BP is already compensating fishermen who can no longer use waters tainted by the oil. But right now, most restaurants say business is as brisk as ever. They just hope it stays that way. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News, New Orleans.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
One day, scientists might add to that collection of space junk in the form of a giant orbiting lens. It's an idea that was written about a few years ago as a way to deflect sunlight away from the Earth to fight global warming. And that plan is among the dozens profiled in a new book on geoengineering. It's called Hack the Planet. Author Eli Kintish spent 3 years following the men and women who believe that the fight against climate change might require a little more than just cutting down on pollution. In fact, in some cases, they believe we may have to increase pollution. Eli Kintish joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I suspect that the comment section on our website will light up with all kinds of accusations against you. So let's just sort of lay down a marker here. Geoengineering is not necessarily the answer to climate change, but if it works, it might be necessary in addition to doing all the other things. Is that essentially what these scientists say?
These scientists view geoengineering as a worst-case scenario response. We might face emergencies in the future which driving a Prius or putting up a windmill or putting a solar panel will not answer. If the ice sheets are melting at a catastrophic rate, if we're finding decade-long droughts are happening that we don't expect, we have to have some sort of emergency response program in place to understand what to do.
They look at it as an insurance policy, in a sense.
Exactly. You wouldn't build a house without buying insurance.
There's something called the Pinatubo option, and you actually met an atmospheric scientist who dismissed it as basically junk science initially. Today, you write about how he has become a believer. He's actually working on a project to prepare to deploy the Pinatubo option if it becomes necessary. What is that project and who is he?
So in 1991, Mount Pinatubo erupted. spewing 10 million tons of sulfur up into the stratosphere above the weather. It's about 5,000 times more powerful than the volcano which went off in Iceland recently. So this supervolcano, its biggest effect was to cool the planet by a degree Fahrenheit.
And it did this by shielding the Earth from the sun's rays?
Right. A certain small percentage of the sun's rays were reflected away from the Earth.
Because of all these particles in the stratosphere.
Right. And one of the problems with geoengineering is the source of the problem with global warming is our greenhouse gases. And to cool the planet with something like the Pinatubo option is not getting at the real cause of the problem. You know, and so as a result, there might be these side effects.
Now, while the Pinatubo option might seem out there, there are some really out there proposals you talk about in the book. One of them is to launch a spacecraft into low Earth orbit and kind of deploy a giant sunshade, a parasol.
The scientists in the 50s and 60s in the Soviet Union had some wild ideas. I mean, they really saw themselves as completely transforming the Earth. And, you know, you find a pamphlet, which I had to go to the Library of Congress to look at, and this pamphlet shows this sort of Saturn rings above the planet, warming certain areas, altering rainfall in others. They really viewed the planet as something that could be reshaped and reformed.
And did people take the idea seriously? That you could have these giant, you know, umbrellas floating around in space, shielding the Earth from the sun?
Well, that's a kind of wild idea, and subsequent scientists thought of building such a shield on the moon and then letting it go, and it would sort of go into orbit around the Earth. But only a couple years ago, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences published a paper by a scientist who suggested putting a giant lens between the Earth and the sun, some million miles away, and that lens would send a certain small fraction of the sun's rays away from the Earth.
Is that possible? I mean, do we have the technology to do that?
That's a possibly multi-trillion dollar project.
Right.
And would probably be the largest physical thing that anyone had built on Earth by a factor of 1,000.
Now, Eli, there are several experiments that have been tried and several that are being tried. And I want to ask you about one of them. You met a scientist who dumps iron dust into the ocean. He wants to figure out if it will boost the level of plankton. I guess the idea being that more plankton would absorb more CO2. Can you tell me about him?
Right. So there are sections of the ocean that have lots of nutrients, but weirdly, no life in them. And Viktor Smedicek, who's a German oceanographer, he believes that they're missing a key nutrient, iron. And so his idea is that you could add a little of this iron and grow giant algae blooms. Now, oceanographers have tried this method in a lot of small experiments, but last year, Smedicek led a 10-week experiment with German and Indian scientists to try doing this on a much larger scale. And part of the reason for that experiment was to understand if maybe adding iron to a section of the Southern Ocean, which rings Antarctica, might offer a way to grow, as he puts it, a garden in the Southern Ocean.
So what do? They just dumped iron particles into the ocean?
They dissolve iron in water, and they send this boat around in a big sort of pinwheel going in larger and larger circles, and they create what's known as a patch of iron. And within this patch, they examine what microorganisms grow.
And did it work?
In this case, it turned out that they grew the wrong kind of algae.
Ah.
The scientists know that adding iron might grow algae. They don't know how it would work as a geoengineering option.
Eli, what about the unintended consequences? I mean, for example, dumping iron dust into the ocean might sound like a good idea, but do some of these experiments actually create pollution and environmental problems?
In the case of fertilizing the ocean to grow giant algae blooms, you might create areas that are deprived of oxygen. You might alter ecosystems in ways you don't understand. You might actually create organisms in your algae patch that put up greenhouse gases more potent than the carbon dioxide, like methane. In the case of the Pinatubo option, which is mimicking the cooling effects of volcanoes, you might damage ozone, and you might actually damage the ability of solar panels to take in energy because you're blocking direct sunlight that those solar panels need to create energy. So by doing geoengineering and removing direct sunlight from the planet system, you're actually undermining the kind of alternative energy we need to get off our fossil fuel addiction.
Hmm. What conclusion did you reach about the viability of all this research? I mean, did you come away with it thinking this is possible?
Well, we certainly know from nature that Volcanic eruptions cool the planet. If you could mimic them effectively, you could cool the planet, at least at first. We know that algae growing in the ocean cools the planet by sucking in carbon dioxide. So there are these natural analogs. What we don't know is how it would work on a mass scale if we tried to mimic them year after year after year. Essentially, we don't know how dangerous geoengineering would be. And the question is, are we going to kill each other trying to find out?
That's Eli Kintish. He's a reporter for Science magazine and the author of the book, Heck the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. Eli, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.